I'm happy now to welcome Lawrence Tharp. He is executive director of the organization Compassion Beyond Borders, which is based here in New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us about this incredible international organization.
Well, I think it's incredible because here we are in New Mexico, educating girls halfway around the world. They're the poorest of the poor. They're refugees, they're orphans, they're what we call untouchables, the Dalits in India. They're ethnic groups, minorities that are discriminated against, religious minorities, every kind, physically handicapped. Every kind of distressed woman and girl, the poorest of the poor, are educated by our organization.
So that's what Compassion Beyond Borders does. It educates women and girls. How did you decide to do women and girls as opposed to a more co-ed type of situation?
Very simple. My concern was with poverty when the organization was founded. I'm educated as an economist. I have a PhD from Columbia University. And just about every economist knows that there's no more cost-effective way of dealing with poverty than to educate girls.
Why is that?
Well, it's counterintuitive because we all know boys are more important than girls, except it's wrong.
We do, anyway.
When a girl grows up in the developing world, and she grows up very quickly, she becomes a mother, and with an education, she has fewer children, she has better educated children, and she has healthier children. Now, what better way to get out of poverty than that? Educating a girl actually starts an avalanche, because not only do her children benefit in that way, their children's children, and on and on and on. This children, this expands out like an avalanche beyond her lifetime. That's why educating girls is the most effective, most cost-effective way of dealing with poverty in the developing world.
So it's not the income or the economic development that these young women produce.
No. We are interested in building community. We are interested in supporting the neighborhood, the society in which these girls live. We're not trying to get a girl to become a professional. It's a very different attitude towards education than we have in the United States. It's almost the opposite, because it's a social orientation, not an individual orientation. And this is especially true of the poor. Because, you know, the root meaning of poverty, of poor, is not having the necessities of life. Well, how do you live without the necessities of life? You live by sharing. And so the poor, that's why the poorest are the people who share a larger percentage of what they have than anybody else in the world. And so that's where community comes from. It comes from that sharing.
It's funny, before you and I went on the air, we were talking about the fact that you work with the most generous people in the world.
Yes, I do. And it's lovely.
So you have projects in all over the place, in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America. How did the organization start, and how did you choose the different locations where you do your work?
The organization started when I visited India 8 years ago. And I had lived in India 40 years before that. And when I went back to India, I was shocked. I saw the same poverty I'd seen before. We hear a lot about the dynamic growth of India, but as an economist, I quickly understood, yes, half or more of the countries which have dynamic economic growth leave their poverty untouched because they don't educate girls. I was shocked. I was ashamed that I had forgotten about this. When I was in India the first time, 45 years ago, I was in the diplomatic corps, the foreign service. I had a passport, you know, a diplomatic passport. I had the ultimate in privileges in society. And I would walk down from my penthouse apartment, and I would see people sleeping on pieces of cardboard in the street. And I didn't like it. And I felt helpless. When I went back, I had had my education in economics. I no longer felt helpless. I knew what to do, and I knew I was going to do it. I vowed I would never again forget these people.
Say more about really ending the cycle of poverty. I mean, when you educate women and girls, how does more money actually flow into the community so that they can get out of poverty?
My explanation was that, first of all, girls have better educated children. If you're better educated, you have more resources to work with, whether it's income, whether you're a better farmer, whatever it is. Fewer children. If a woman has fewer children, she has more to give to each individual child. And I don't need to say anything about reducing population growth. That's too obvious. Healthier children. If you're healthier, you're a more productive citizen. You don't die when you're 3 years old, and so on. So this simple stuff of educating girls to be better mothers, which is one way of saying what we're on about, that moves families out of poverty.
Tell us about some of the specific programs. In India, you're working with the so-called untouchable castes of society. What are their lives like?
You know, I see these children in school. The untouchables, the proper name is Dalit. We don't know that name so well in the United States. It's a part of the Indian caste system. Our projects are in the Indian state of Bihar, which is the poorest state in India. And in that state, there are about 1,000 castes. And we work with the Musahar. That caste is at the absolute bottom of the social structure in Bihar. So these are literally the poorest of the poor. Now, Musahar translates as rat eater.
Oh,
and that's
goodness.
Exactly right. These people survive by eating rats. So we educate them. And they then begin to see the value of education, and they start then to go to public schools. They start to move out of this being captured in a terrible existence. These people live in ghettos. They live in their own villages. And, you know, and I say they have a terrible existence. These children are not the most, I don't know what word to use here, disadvantaged children I come across, in fact. The AIDS orphans in Kenya are far more disadvantaged. And it's a real learning experience for me. You can be a rat eater with an intact family, and you're a healthier human being than an AIDS orphan in Kenya with a higher income.
Right. Do these rat eaters change their diets eventually and stop eating rats?
If their income rises, they can do that. But we're at the very beginning of this process.
How do you work with organizations in the places that you go to and with existing infrastructures there?
We have a very particular mode of operation, which is we discover local groups which are doing good work, and we fund them. We don't start anything, and we don't, especially don't do our own projects. So everything is locally organized. And because of that, we can have projects around the world, a variety of countries, without knowing how to run those projects, because the local people know how to run them in each of their locations. We fund them. And then I visit them to make sure the funds are being used properly. We check for honesty. We check for competence.
I was just reading Greg Mortensen's new book, Stones into Schools, about Afghanistan. And he came from a family where he really believed that the thing to do is, even if you start a project, it must end up in the hands of the local people. You're starting out with the project in the hands of the local people.
Yes, and it's never been otherwise. It's so easy to think that we, as Americans, have the answers. I learned from living abroad that we don't have the answers for other cultures. We can advise. We have a lot to give. But they need to make the decisions. And so we never made that mistake, which so many organizations make.
You also have a project in Afghanistan. And one of the things about that place is that there's basically an entire generation of women that wasn't educated because they were living under the Taliban, and so that requires a whole educational approach, which is different than educating first graders on up.
Yes, what we're doing there is we've found a wonderful Afghan organization which opens classrooms for us in neighborhoods where there are no schools for girls. So the girls who attend these classrooms might be anywhere from 6 to 16 or 18, but women as old as 50 come to these classes. Now, the married women are separated from the younger women. they're in different classes. But we're educating 1,000 girls in Afghanistan, and including we have 13 groups in Taliban area. And so people say, how's that possible? You know, our director there is a very savvy woman. She's obviously a feminist, and she's a very conservative woman. She dresses in black, which is not normal. I mean, that's more conservative than normal. Before she even starts a classroom, she will go to the village elders and get their okay. She goes to the neighborhood council. She gets their okay. She goes to the local mullahs, the clerics, gets their okay. Okay, now that she has those okays, she starts her classroom. The Taliban says, what am I going to do? In fact, the Taliban says, you know, these girls need to learn how to take care of themselves. I've wondered whether they tolerate the schools or whether they actually support them. They've told our director that they support them.
That's very interesting. That totally flies in the face of what we've been told in the media about the Taliban and their war on women and girls and all of that.
It does. My experience with the Taliban has nothing to do with what the media says. I mean, they're different planets. My personal experience, I mean, I was there last August and September in Afghanistan. I visited these classrooms. The Afghan culture is very conservative. In order for me to visit a classroom, we needed permission from the mullahs, the elders, the council. Not all of them gave it, but enough of them gave permission so I could go into the classroom, take photographs. I came home with 600 photographs. And I talked with the girls, I interviewed them, I watched the teaching, and I was very fortunate. My translator, who's a man on the staff in Afghanistan, could not enter those classes. An Afghan man couldn't enter. But they got permission for me to enter, only when I was accompanied by 3 women, plus the teacher. So it's very exceptional. It's a very conservative society, but our director knows how to manage it.
When you start a program like that, what is that process like?
We had 2 previous projects in Afghanistan, and I wasn't satisfied with either one. I went to the internet. I did a search for women's organizations in Afghanistan that were interested in education. I found 13. I wrote them emails. I got 7 answers. I set up appointments. 3 of them kept the appointments. The first 2 were not appropriate for us. One of them worked with USAID. They had a fleet of 13 cars. That's not the kind of stuff we do.
Right.
The third woman I was interviewing, she knew what my interests were, and she looked at me as if to say, what are you, crazy American, coming here to tell me you're going to give me $20,000 when I don't know a thing about you? I mean, she was cold as ice for 45 minutes. At the end of the interview, she decided it was for real. And now we have a fabulous relationship. She doesn't speak English. We use translators. But we trust each other. I'm amazed by her competence. And she relies on me to give the money. And I promised to give it. We're now budgeting them at $40,000 a year. We're educating 1,000 girls. We're giving a girl a complete primary school education for $125.
I mean, that's the other amazing thing about this, that the amount of money that you need to educate these women and girls is so tiny compared to in a first world country.
Compared to a first world country, or compared to what other organizations are doing.
Right.
I'm an economist. I was born in the Great Depression. I don't want to waste somebody else's money, because our organization works through donations. I don't want to waste somebody else's money. We're very careful.
We're talking to Lauren Tharp, executive director of the organization Compassion Beyond Borders. Let's talk about your work in Kenya. You have an extensive program there.
Yes, in some ways it's our most extensive program. It has 2 parts. One part, we educate primary school girls. We work with the local chiefs. In my discussions with the chief, they told me that 40 to 45% of the AIDS orphan girls are not in primary school. That's shocking. Okay, we started a program to get them in school, working with the local chiefs. We give scholarships to secondary school girls. Secondary school, only in the area we're working in western area Kenya, only 7% of the girls are in high school. High school fees are so high that most girls can't go to school. So we give secondary school scholarships.
Now, when you say so high for them, but
yes.
What is it?
It's $150.
$150 a year.
$150 is one-third of the poverty level. So if you think of one-third of your income going to just to finance your high school education.
4 months' worth of paychecks, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is. Then we send girls to the university to study education. And finally, we have a class, adult education class, for women with AIDS. So primary school, secondary school, university, women, adult women. We got the whole spectrum covered, all with AIDS orphans, AIDS women, AIDS mothers.
What is people's morale like whom you meet? I mean, having a country devastated by an illness like that.
Well, believe it or not, when I go to visit the AIDS Center, I am met by dancing and singing. I am met with garlands of flowers. I am met with a celebration like I have never seen in my life. The Kenyan people I know love to dance, they love to sing, and they love to celebrate. If you go to church with them, the entire service is the congregation singing with a short homily. And they just sing, and they're dancing in the aisles, and there's drums going, and they're swaying back and forth, and they're clapping their hands, and they're doing this kind of, I'm going to call it yodeling, that's not the right word, but these are happy people.
So their culture is just so strong. I mean, imagine even Santa Fe, or imagine a typical American city devastated by AIDS.
The difference is community. If you're surrounded by caring people who are sharing your concerns because they got the same concerns, you're all in it together, and it's all okay. You know, it doesn't get any better than you have solid human relationships. You know, one of the things I've discovered, and my work has taught me so much, here in the United States, we have one of the highest standards of living in the world. And what does that mean? We have lots of objects to relate to. And what is it like to be poor? You don't have any objects, or very few. So what do? You relate to human beings. That's the difference between the United States and the poorest of the poor in the world. Relating to objects and relating to people. It's a big difference.
Yeah, and if you think about it, I think sometimes we relate to other people here through our objects.
We do. And I'm not painting a black and white situation, but where the emphasis is.
What I mean is you can't dance and sing on Facebook.
Yes, as I say, when I go to the AIDS Center, I'm met by 100 women who are thanking me for educating their daughters. They're thanking me for learning to read and write, and they even have computer instruction. And so there's this generosity, it's this thankfulness, it's this appreciation. The definition of poverty from the World Bank is a level of income about 1/100th of what the average person in the United States has. That's how poor they are. Well, so all they have is other people.
If I just did the calculation right, that's a dollar a day.
It's a dollar and a quarter. And if you want to do another calculation, it's the cost of living of a cat or a dog in the United States.
Good heavens.
Yes. There's 1.25 billion people in the world who have a standard of living equal to a cat or a dog in the United States. Those are the people we work with. Actually, we work with the poorest of those people. That's just the poor. The poorest of the poor are even worse.
In India, you have two different kinds of projects. One is with Indian people and one is with Tibetan refugees.
Yes.
Tell us about those. It was interesting to me to read that the Tibetan refugees who have children born in India, those children are no longer eligible for certain assistance from the UN because they're not born in Tibet.
Yes, technically they're not refugees because they're born in India. So we educate these girls. I visit these Tibetan communities, and you know, it's unlike any other experience I have. It almost wants to make me believe in benevolent dictatorship because the whole thing's run by the Dalai Lama. There's no democracy, none at all.
Right.
But I have never seen such community, with the exception of one orphanage in Kenya.
So your work there, tell us about the work in the Tibetan refugee communities.
We give scholarships to girls. The Tibetan education system includes both it's in India, so it has to comply with Indian laws, but then it includes as well the Tibetan education system, so there's really two going on at once. The girls begin studying and Tibetan. And they then, after fifth grade, begin studying in English. They get an international education. They get instruction in their culture from the Tibetan lamas. They learn the Indian languages. They learn three languages in school. They have 3 years of nursery school, preschool, and then they go into primary school, the Indian education system. So we start with three-year-olds, sending them to nursery school. And then we follow them through high school.
And in India, not the Tibetan communities, but the Indian communities, what do you do there?
We have a variety of programs. We talked about the Musahar, the untouchables, the rat eaters. Let me speak of another community. In the south of India, we give scholarships to girls who live in 40 rural villages. And these are tribal girls. Now, many people don't know that there's tribal people in India, but there's, just like New Mexico, there's tribal people. These tribal people, and they've been tribal people for 3,500 years. Not 500 years, 3,500 years. They've had their separate culture and their separate way of living in the forest, away from the rest of the Indian population. Well, so what happens? At the end of the last decades, the lumbering companies came in and cut down the forest. And they had nothing. And they finally had to face up to living with the modern culture. We work with 40 villages. They are so remote that when I went to visit them, I commented to the director, they gave me wonderful receptions and welcoming ceremonies. He says, yes, but you have to remember, they've never seen a foreigner before. You are the first foreigner ever to visit their villages. So we're working with these people in this remote area. And frankly, throughout the world, most of our work is in rural, remote areas. We're helping the girls go to school. Within 1 year of supporting their education, the number of girls in school in these 40 villages increased 25%. When I went there, there was one girl in her first year of university studies. I went back a year and a half, there were 10. So I'm often asked, what evidence is that you actually accomplished anything? Well, I see it a lot. So we're helping these girls get an education. And interestingly, these people are so poor that female infanticide had been very common in the past years. Now, by the time I got there, it had mainly stopped. But we're educating girls who a generation ago wouldn't even be alive. And what we're doing is we're showing to their parents how valuable they are, because they will become skillful, they will earn an income, they'll become good mothers. And so we're proving to those parents that they made the right decision in keeping that girl alive.
You work mainly in rural areas. Why not urban areas?
You know, it's not nice to tell tales in other organizations. But when American organizations work abroad, the American staff doesn't want to live in a village. They want to live in Nairobi. They want to live in New Delhi. They want to live in Guatemala City, whatever. And so that's where most of the help goes.
So basically, the city's already covered.
It's not covered adequately. But the point is, the rural areas is abandoned, ignored. Or sometimes it's the tourist areas. I visit a tourist area as a tourist, and I find these French organizations or Dutch organizations that are helping in the tourist areas because some French or Dutch tourists came there and started something. We, in Guatemala, for example, we work in the mountains, in the Mayan villages. No tourist goes there.
Do they speak Spanish in those areas, or is it all indigenous languages?
In the rural areas, people speak their indigenous language, and the education system is in Spanish. And amazingly, this last year, while I was actually visiting Guatemala 10 months ago, the government passed a law that required village schools to teach the native language. Required. All girls now in rural areas are educated in their own language as well as Spanish. Now, in the urban areas, the indigenous language have been lost. So the law doesn't apply to urban areas because they don't know the language to begin with.
So basically, all of these village children end up being bilingual.
Yeah, they're going to be. Now, this is just last year.
Yeah.
There, up until this last year, there, last several years, there had been enormous discrimination against the Mayan people. And just let me say that we only work with Mayan people in Guatemala. You know, we pick out the group that is discriminated against. We work with them. This last year, the government passed a law that the Mayan girls can wear the traditional clothing to school as a uniform. First time ever. And we have a girl studying to be a nurse. And of the 400 children in her school, she's the only one who wears her native clothing. And these people are so poor, this is unbelievable, they're so poor they can't even buy their own clothing. We buy it for them so they can wear it as a school uniform. Just like in with working with Tibetan children, we sponsor them and they learn the Tibetan language. Tibetan language is not taught in China. It's not allowed.
In Chinese-occupied Tibet.
In Chinese-occupied Tibet. Only in the refugee camps is Tibetan taught, and we sponsor that. So we support the culture of these people in refugee camps of the Tibetan children, in the Guatemalan Mayan girls. It's one of our goals.
Tell us about your other Latin American programs.
We have projects in Mexico. Our projects in Juarez, and both of the projects are in abandoned, so-called abandoned garbage dumps. They're not really abandoned. People are squatted on the garbage dumps. People have been driven out of their traditional homes in southern Mexico with the modernization of agriculture. They have nothing. They go to Juarez, where the maquiladoras are, the foreign factories, and they try to get jobs there. And they have no place to live, so they squat on these garbage dumps. We have two projects there, both working out of women's centers, educating the girls in those garbage dumps.
Now, this work has been going on for not very long. I mean, you started the whole thing 8 years ago. I imagine that over the next decade to two decades, you'll really be able to see the longer-term effects of this kind of work.
Let me tell you a story. I mentioned that Compassion Beyond Borders was founded 7 years ago. 15 years ago, I was in Guatemala for 8 months, and I got to know the maid in the language school where I was studying. When I came back to the United States, we stayed in contact with each other. And at one point, she asked me for help educating her daughter. Her daughter was so poor, and the family was so poor, the daughter couldn't even go to middle school. She was working as a maid in Guatemala City. So we sent her some money. And the daughter, Claudia, from time to time would write and ask for some more money, but she mainly found the money herself. She completed middle school. She completed high school. She went to nursing training. Well, actually, in between, she'd become a bilingual secretary. She did nursing training. She worked in a nursing center in a small village. I visited her a couple years ago. She was in a mountain village. She had responsibility for 26 other villages. She was in charge of prenatal and postnatal care in those villages. She had 12 girls, young women, who she had trained. They had no professional training other than what she personally gave to them. Together, she and her team had reduced the death rate of children in these villages from 12 to 4 a year. Claudia was saving 8 lives a year. So that goes back to the, even before this organization. The organization helped her finish her education. It's an example. And we didn't even furnish most of the money. Most of the money she arranged herself.
Yeah, and so the ripple effect of that in a community is, well, I was going to say incalculable, but you're an economist. Can you calculate things like that?
And economists can do that. You know, economists can calculate the effect of these budget changes and the health system. It can be calculated. You have to put a value on a human life. That's a challenge. But I don't think it's the numerical value that counts. I think it's the human value that mothers don't see their children die.
Lawrence Tharp is the executive director of the organization Compassion Beyond Borders, which is on the web at compassionbb.org. Now, how do you actually get the funding to do this work?
Our funding, that's another avalanche. We have a board which supports our work. They make the board members contribute to our work. Also, they give us mailing lists of their friends. So we send fundraising letters to their friends and neighbors, family members. 20% of our income comes from the board. Another 20% comes from these mailing lists. Now, what's amazing is these people on the mailing list talk to their neighbors and their family members and their friends, and that gives us 40%. It's the avalanche.
Right.
The third generation of givers is actually the largest. It gets bigger as you go down. And that's very encouraging to us. I mean, they voluntarily give to us without our even contacting them.
One of the things that I think is amazing about your organization is that it is truly an all-volunteer organization, and so there's not money spent on all sorts of overhead or luxuries for the staff.
Obviously, we have overhead. It costs money to send out letters, have printers, and so on. But the overhead is covered by the board members. 100% of donations to this organization reach the girls. Now, compare that to the average figure in the United States is 30 to 35% goes to overhead.
Now, one more thing. You are going to have an exhibition of the photographs that you've made doing your work for Compassion Beyond Borders in Albuquerque.
Yes. When I travel, I take as many photographs as possible because that is our primary means of fundraising. We demonstrate to donors what we're doing with these photographs. Well, I was invited a year ago to do an exhibition of these photos, 40 of them in Albuquerque, and I was invited back. So this afternoon I'm going down to hang this exhibit. It'll be open for the month of January.
And there's an opening on January 10th from 4:30 to 6, and it's at the Jewish Community Center of Albuquerque at 5520 Wyoming Boulevard in Albuquerque.
Yes, and I'll be doing a presentation there on the work of Compassion Beyond Borders with a PowerPoint presentation of what we're doing.
Excellent. For more information, people can call 505-332-0565.
Yes, that's the number of the center where the exhibit is taking place.
Well, if people would like to find out more about this organization, they can go to compassionbb.org. Lawrence Tharp, Executive Director of Compassion Beyond Borders, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.